Hey, what's up, everyone? This is WDET's Sam Bobian, and we are back here for another Sam's Jams Live here on WDET. And right now, I'm in the studio with jazz saxophonist Wendell Harrison. So, Wendell, you know, I wanted to take this opportunity to play your music, talk about it with our listeners. You know, I've been a huge fan of music for a long time. We've played together before. And I just wanted to play some music and talk about it. So, you know, you were born here in Detroit, right?
I was born in 1942.
Yeah.
At the Wilma's Hospital.
And, you know, growing up at that time in the city, I think what's interesting about Detroit is you think of its, I don't think a lot of people always think of its huge impact it had on jazz. You look at all those Blue Note records, there's so many Detroit jazz musicians on all those classic Blue Note records. Yeah. People from Donner Byrd, Joe Henderson, all these people that kind of came out
Jones.
Of Thad Jones, right?
And Jones
a lot of them
brothers.
Came out of Cass Tech,
yeah.
You know? And I think, like, it's interesting thinking about Detroit versus New York versus all these other places because, you know, I think the public school system here was pretty incredible, and a lot of the musicians kind of came out of the public school system.
They did. You know, back in the 40s and 50s, the economy was great here because of the factory industry, you know, that was the economy. You know, everybody worked the factory, and they came up from the South, and it was people were making money, and they was going into business, and the parents invested a lot of money in education. You know, they send their kids, they stressed education, like, and they were sending their kids to Cass Tech. That was one of the best academics and classical schools in the Midwest.
Well, why do you think Detroit musicians were so, you know, were on so many of those records? Why do you think Detroit musicians had such an impact on that you know, era of jazz?
Well, the main thing, Detroit is kind of conservative in the way of we like to study and really like when Bird would come here and play. A lot of people paid attention and really idolized Charlie Parker, you know. Same with John Coltrane, he would come here and stay. They would work the area, like I was saying, in the 40s and 50s. They would just work this area. And they influenced a lot of young people, you know. Like we had the Bluebird Lounge, and people would come to the Bluebird, I mean kids. The owner was... His name was Clarence Eddings. He worked the factory, you know, but he put all his money into the club, you know. And on Sundays, we have kids. He invited the kids to come and hear the music. It was underage, but we had to go into the alley and listen to the music in the back door, from the back door.
And you got to study with one of the greatest jazz educators of all time, Barry Harris.
Barry Harris, yeah. I studied with Barry when I was 14 years old.
What was it like learning with him? What was his technique and his style?
Taskmaster.
Like?
he was great. You know, he would talk. He would make fun of you. You know, tell jokes and stuff like that. But he really encouraged you to work on your lesson. He'd give you a lesson or exercises to learn. When you don't come back that night prepared.
So now I want to listen to a song by Barry Harris and his rendition of Hot House.
Thank you.
gonna tell you a story about Barry. I was studying with Barry, and when I heard Train, I was about 17 years old, 17, 18. I heard Train at the minor key. Man, I said, wow. I started listening, and I started copying Train. So I went to, I was really proud of myself. So I went to a lesson with Barry, and I thought he was going to approve. This is like in the 50s, like 50, 58 or 59 or something like that. And I played an idea that I got from Train. And he said, oh, I don't want those Looney Tunes played in my house. That's ridiculous. Don't play none of those. That sound I can't stand. Don't come in my house playing like that. Say, really? I was like, and I was pretty rebellious at that time. So I said, okay, bye-bye, you know.
Yeah.
Because, like, I had to. That was the sound of that time.
Yeah.
And it inspired me. Everybody was trying to.
He was a purist. He was a purist with bebop language.
He was a keeper of the books, you know. And you really needed a guy like that for foundation. Barry gave me the key. In fact, I wrote a bebop method book based on his tutelage. And we deal with language, basic language, bebop language, which gives you the key in terms of the general idea of improvisation. Now, once you get it, I don't play like Barry, you know. Once you get it, you could take it and go somewhere else. You put your own self and take it somewhere else. But the point is, he's giving you foundation. He was giving you foundation.
So when you moved to New York in the early 60s, right? From Detroit.
1960.
And how did you meet Sun Ra?
Oh, I was staying at a loft with Keani Sawade, Bernard McKinney, Harold McKinney's brother. And we was practicing, and we was studying yoga, the Eastern philosophy. We was vegetarians and whatnot, you know. And Keani would introduce us to different band leaders and whatnot. And it was kind of like a referral service because of like people would call down there and ask, is there a tenor player down there by the name of Wendell Harrison? One day the phone rang from Sun Ra.
And this is pretty somewhat early in Sun Ra's career, you know, but he, you know, at that time he had some albums that were like a little bit more like world music sounding with different percussion and different things. At this time when you're playing with him, was he like really out avant-garde music or was it a little mixture of everything?
No, he had just got there from, he brought his whole band from Chicago and he got there in 58. I arrived in 60, you know, and he would always tell me, if you make these gigs, you're going to work with everybody else. That's how it is. I'm giving you an opportunity. This is a platform, you know. That's how he sold this, because he wasn't playing that much money.
Well, I think what's interesting about that, what you're saying, you know, I think by like the late 60s, I think it's like 1968, you started playing with a musician named Hank Crawford. But playing with Hank Crawford's how you met Marcus Belgrave for the first time.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
And what's interesting about Hank Crawford is, you know, being from Detroit, you know, you had a great jazz background, but in Detroit, we had also had a big soul and R&B thing here at Motown, right?
Yeah.
You played with Marvin Gaye a little bit.
Yeah.
You've played with Aretha a little bit at that point.
Right.
By the time you got to New York, you were kind of digging deep into the avant-garde scene.
Yeah.
But, you know, you still have that Detroit kind of soul roots in you, right? So Hank Crawford is kind of like this R&B, soul-driven saxophone player.
Yeah.
His music is pretty accessible to a lot of people because it's like kind of like dance-based,
you
know, dance-based, blues-based music. I want to listen to a track. This is a track called Someday.
Someday.
Do you remember this one?
Yeah.
So I want to listen to this track here. This is a track that you're playing on. I think Marcus is on this too as well, isn't he?
Yeah,
so let's check it out.
Oh, yeah. We play that in Detroit.
Sounds like a Detroit
track. Yeah. But it also has, it still has that, because he's from the South, right?
He's a Southern. He's from Memphis.
So this really has that Memphis soul, Stax kind of thing, which was still influenced by Motown a little bit, you know?
Yeah, well, that was the music of that day. You know, people was dancing to the boogaloo. We call this the boogaloo beat.
So what year did you move out to California?
67, just before train pass.
Hmm.
You know.
And you got a chance to work with Greg Dykes. So what can you tell us about this track? I want to listen to a song that I Will Greatly Rejoice. This is from this album. What can you tell us about this album? It's a pretty interesting project.
Well, this is a Synanon project. And when I went to Synanon, I was kicking a drug habit. A heroin habit. And while I was out there in California, I was working, and Greg Dykes, he was like the musical director for Synanon. And we was playing in a club on the beach. And we was playing every night in a supper club. And Art Pepper would play with us, and a lot of great musicians was in Synanon.
What is Synanon? What is that?
It was a rehabilitation drug center.
So the Synanon choir is a bunch of patients?
A bunch of patients.
Wow.
With Esther Phillips. Mm. She's a star. It was a lot of famous people that were there. Not only musicians, but doctors and lawyers. And it was like high echelon of folks that had got trapped into the alcohol pill trap, you know?
Yeah.
And so in 68, I stayed out there 2 years. But meanwhile, Greg Dykes wrote a cantata based on the Matthew's and Isaiah chapters of the Bible, you know? Mm. And he put an orchestra, he arranged, he wrote the music and put, arranged the orchestra. You know, and Synanon paid these musicians, union musicians.
That's really interesting. I did not know that about that project, that it was all kind of rehab patients.
Yeah, rehab.
So let's hear a little bit of that. This is the Synanon Choir, and the song is called I Will Greatly Rejoice.
I was listening to Train. I'm sounding like more like Train now.
Yeah, this is you here, right here, playing sax.
Yeah. I was 26.
Yeah, I definitely hear some Coltrane influence on that
I was into it.
I mean, so
now,
this was...
Now, alluding to that, Naima was my girlfriend, his ex-wife. I was staying in his house for 4.5 years. From like 63 to 66, 67, you know.
You stayed in John Coltrane's house?
Yeah, on Mexico Street in St. Alma's, Long Island. Hmm. He would come by and check us out. Because he had married Alice.
Yeah.
At that time. But he had his recording studio. He took everything out, but he still had his... she made the recording studio a laundry room. You know,
what was it like to be so close to someone that you kind of really looked up to like that?
I was young. I didn't look at. He wasn't like that to me. You know, he was great, but not. He wasn't an icon.
Yeah, at that point, yeah.
To me, because I'm still 22, 23. But Train would come out and talk to her about business and whatnot. He liked to play my horn. He wanted to play my horn and stuff.
Wow. So let me ask you, so with the Synanon Choir and playing and kind of using, you know, that time period to recover and to kick your habit at that time, like, so just focusing on music kind of try to keep you out of trouble, right? Just trying to stay busy with the music.
That's what it was. It was like a constant distraction.
Yeah.
You know, and when I came back to Detroit, I continued that constant.
And what year was it that you came back to Detroit?
70.
Mm. And not long after you co-founded Tribe, right?
Because I was constantly concentrating.
Yeah.
The thing is, I was trying to stay clean. Mm. Trying to stay clean. It's trying to, you know, so, and my parents, it was, you know, they was concerned about me too, because, like, you know, they were middle class. I was an embarrassment, you know. Mm. Like my mother was a school teacher. She had a master's in education. My father had a PhD. You know, he was teaching at Southern University. And then my grandfather was a doctor. You know, so music was strange to them. Mm. You know, how do you make money in music? They didn't know anything about the entertainment business, and say we got enough clowns as it is in terms of entertainers and whatnot. So they was trying to get me into like pharmacy, be a pharmacist or a doctor or something that they could understand.
So that really pushed you when you were in Foreign Tribe to like it's a big. You know, it wasn't just a record label. It had a magazine. It was a business. It was a community involvement thing. It was a little bit of everything, right? So when you moved here, you got involved with Metro Arts in Detroit, which was an educational place, right?
Yeah. It's the Tribe just snowballed, you know, into all those businesses. Because I was just trying, I didn't think about what it was, what I was doing. I was just trying not to be bored.
I see.
You know, and every time I would pick up something new, okay, for instance, I started teaching at Metro Arts. That was nice because I never taught formally before. But I had a methodology to teach from Barry Harris, you know. So that was nice, and the income was good. Then I started producing concerts with Phil Ranlin and Marcus Belgrade. And at the time, people just wanted to work with me because I was kind of like famous. This guy recording, he's young, and I had a lot of credibility at that particular time. So we started putting this program together and started doing concerts at the DIA every quarter, you know, dealing with Charles Moore, Marcus Belgrade, Phil Ranlin.
And Phil told me the story that you guys actually started making the records. He was calling it more of like a calling card, like a way to promote these shows.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, now these records are like hugely remembered as very iconic albums.
When we started out, they were musicals because I was writing big, you know, big productions and stuff. And we promoted and dealing with the this program book, which became Tribe Magazine after a couple of issues, because Herb Boyd say, we got a lot of ads. Some of my students can write some articles, and we put some articles. It could be actually a great magazine for the community.
If you had to explain what Tribe was to a listener out there that maybe isn't familiar, what is Tribe?
Tribe was people getting together to survive. Like any other tribe in the world, people come together to sustain their future in terms of sustaining their family. Like we at this particular time, we had musicians here that recorded from Motown. Motown had left, you know, and they had recorded, I'm talking about Phil and Marcus and other folks, musicians here that was out of work, which they had recorded for Motown, but the music was put on the shelf. We're going to do this together. We're going to do this venture together. We're going to put our music out, finally, ourselves. So I had some kind of vision of being with Sun Ra. I had some kind of image to deal with, how to go about doing it, mm-hmm. you know. And then Marcus, he had his way of doing it. Phil had his idea. And Harold. So we argued every week on what would be the best way, how to go about stuff, you know.
So I want to listen to a song from Evening with the Devil, uh-huh. which came out in 1972. Uh-huh. The song is called Angry Young Man Part 1. And this is off of the first album that was released under Wendell Harrison, correct?
Yeah.
So let's check it out. This is Angry Young Man Part 1. You know, I think now these days, these Tribe records are really huge collector's items for record collectors and everyone. It's really, they go for a lot of money. The original pressings are really hard to find.
Yeah.
And at what point did you realize that people were going back and collecting these records like that?
About 10 years ago, 15 years ago, the records was really being sold on eBay for $1,500 to $1,800 on eBay. And then we started getting a lot of vinyl companies. Like we have about 15 vinyl companies that we license to every year.
So what was like the approach? Because the next song I want to listen to is called What We Need. which was under Tribe. What was like kind of like the approach, like the sonic approach? When I listen to these records, like I said, they have like a really unique sonic texture to it when I listen to them. Like, what was the approach when you were doing that?
We went to, this was out in Fraser, Michigan. We did all this at one day. One day. We had the rhythm section in one room, and we had five horns playing over a pool table. Because we was reading music on the pool table. We was all sitting around the pool table. We had our music. And so the horns was isolated from the rhythm section. Those days, when we played a gig, it wasn't no break in between the tunes. It was a continuous track going from one tune to the next. We were like morph into another tune, tempo-wise and everything. Everybody, you look around, we're doing some space stuff, and you look at, listen again, we into some kind of tempo that was conjured up by somebody. You know, we wrote these tunes and stuff like that, but everybody was interpreting and putting their two cents into it.
Well, this is a really beautiful track. I want to take a listen to it. This is the song What We Need and is by Tribe. That was the beautiful song What We Need by Tribe. It's from the album A Message from the Tribe in 1972.
Phil Ranlon wrote it.
Phil wrote that one, yeah. And I think that really gives a great, you know, our listeners a great view of what Tribe was, because it talks a lot about community. It has the experimental kind of like jazz qualities to it, but also has some soulfulness to it that kind of reminds me of Detroit. I think that's a great example of what the Tribe sound is, and I really love that track and that record. So what can you tell me about the song Farewell to Welfare and that album?
Well, we went into the studio, Phil and myself, and we did Farewell to the Welfare, which is a maybe about six tunes. And we did Vibes from the Tribe, which is about six tunes. Phil put his out right away. I came out with a 7-inch 45, and I put stuff out. I might have put out He's the One We All Knew on my Winhaw label, maybe 4 or 5 years later. But I wasn't comfortable with putting the whole thing out for some strange reason, you know. So Ethan,
which is a record collector
and
producer out in California, has a group, a label called Now Again.
They
reissue so much. He goes all over the country and finds people just like you and helps get their music out.
So him and Madlib came to my studio. I don't know how they got there, but it was there. And I have a rack just like this, but it's filled with analog tapes. The 2-inch, 16 tracks, the 1-inch and half-inch, quarter-inch. And he started looking. So, oh, this is Tribe stuff, Tribe stuff. And he said, oh, Farewell to the Welfare. Oh, this is, you got more tunes on. So, see, he found the
tunes.
That's
like finding gold for a record collector, for our listeners out there that they know. Finding an unreleased Tribe album by Wendell is like finding gold. It's like he probably almost had a heart attack in that moment.
Yeah, and I forgot about it. So so it was on a 7.5 reel, it was a half inch reel, and it had a bunch of tunes on. It's called Farewell to the Welfare, but it had about 6 tunes on there that I had forgotten all about. Mm. So he said, let me take this, man. You never done, he said, he asked me if I ever did anything with it. I said, no. I just pulled out that one tune that was popular. So he took it, he went to the bank and brought back some cash and took the tapes to California and transferred them over and actually remastered them. He remastered them, come up with a clean sound, you know. And I said, and when he brought it back, I said, this is great. This is really great. So he put it out on his label, and then he licensed it to the Japanese label called Ultra Vibe.
And Japan really loves kind of underground jazz vinyl from the 70s in the United States. They really collect that stuff out there.
Yeah, it's another label in Japan that licensed our whole catalog and magazines. P-Vine, you saw that, right?
Yeah, and those magazines are coming out for people who have never had a chance to see those. You're going to have a chance to read the original Tribe magazines with the ads, all the beautiful poems and all the amazing stuff that's in there
that
it's like really, the only way you could ever really find that stuff was if you were like a huge collector in Detroit.
Right.
So I want to take a listen to that song, Farewell to Welfare, and this was from 1975. Another song that's on that album, you know, that I really love, that you've actually recorded a bunch of times, is a song called Tons and Tons of BS.
Oh, yeah.
Now, what's interesting,
That was on the original session as well.
Yeah, so that one wasn't released until recently, but that song is on a few of your albums.
Yeah.
You have that. I'm assuming our listeners can use their imagination to know what Tons and Tons of BS means.
This is a daily madness of just living on Earth and trying to survive, you know. You know, it might be anything, depending on who you are, you know. Like, for instance, if you check your email, your emails a day, a lot of times this is tons and tons of BS that's coming through trying to get your attention.
And this is a great song because I feel like this is one that seems like you've used as a vehicle to kind of like showcase your saxophone playing too. And your clarinet playing, I've heard you play this on clarinet. I've heard you play this on saxophone. So this is a great one. Let's check it out. This is, as far as I know, the original version of Tons and Tons of BS. Thank you. an amazing song by Wendell Harrison there. Tons and tons of BS.
Bullshit.
Yeah. from his album from 1975, which is just being released recently, never was released at that time, which is titled Farewell to Welfare. You know, Wendell, by the late 70s, you know, and early 80s, you know, the sounds were kind of shifting a little bit, right? We were getting into synthesizers were happening.
Right.
Dance music was starting to come out. And by the early 80s, you had started your own label called Wenha.
Right.
I think what's interesting about Wenha is I listened to, I think, one of the first ones in 1980, Dreams of a Love Supreme.
Yeah.
Which has you, amazing cover, looks like you're flying like Superman.
I was a drunk.
Yeah. this is a great track, so I want to check this song out. This is a song you wrote called Take Time Out.
Yeah. Well, no, Pam wrote that too.
Oh, this is written by Pam, your wife.
Yeah.
Oh, beautiful. This is a great song called Take Time Out. Some great, you know, music right there that is kind of taking, you know, the synthesizers of the time, 1982, some really early synthesizer stuff.
Early stuff.
And another song I want to check out too, which is really gets danceable, is a song called Love Juice. What can you tell me about the track Love Juice?
We was having a lot of sex at that time. Self-explanatory.
Let's listen to it. This is Love Juice from your album Organic Dream that came out in 1981.
Thank you.
So that was the song Love Juice, which is from 1981, your album Organic Dream. You know, 1981, you know, seemed to be a great year for your label, Wenhai. You have another artist I see on here called William Odell Hughes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That was like Pam's friend. So one day she brought Odell over to record some stuff. Really some dance, commercial stuff, you know.
Yeah, the song that I want to hear by William Odell Hughes is called Super Funkagalastic Freak. Yeah. You know, which is, to me, kind of maybe reminiscent of George Clinton. Yeah, that kind of vibe. So, yeah, let's check it out. This is a great song.
Attention, the Super Funkagalastic Freak has landed.
She's a what?
Freak, freak, freak.
To it like this.
So there's another artist. There's another artist on the label, which has got a really cool name, The Real Shooby Doo.
Yeah.
What's the Real Shooby Doo?
Shooby Doo is a heck of a bass player.
Let's check it out. This is also from 1981 on the Wenhai label. This is The Real Shooby Doo and his song Reminiscing. Thank you. So, you know, over all these years, kind of going through different sounds and these different textures in your playing, you mentioned that there was a resurgence of, you know, people collecting these old records and doing different things. And someone right here in Detroit who has been appreciated your sound for a long time, which is Carl Craig.
Oh.
You know, Carl Craig is, you know, one of the first times I saw you play live was at Movement Detroit Electronic Music Festival. We guys were playing on top of these, like, techno records.
Marcus introduced me to Carl. And what happened was Carl was going to Europe. He was supposed to go to Europe with Carl. And he said, I can't do it. He had another engagement. So I filled in for Marcus. But then Carl, after I played, Carl was digging what I was doing, you know. So I started, when I went over there, I recorded over in Paris at the Pompidou Museum with Carl Craig, and we started working Germany and Spain. And
what's it like working with Carl Craig, compared to working with maybe a traditional jazz arranger, a jazz composer? He comes from a different kind of background. What's it like working with someone like Carl Craig?
It's a different kind of thing. The way they produce music is like building a house. A lot of overdubs. So now, I like that because, you can conceptualize a lot of stuff, you know. They're dealing with a lot of plugins, a lot of electronics and stuff. That's what is good. It is really interesting as I'm playing, and all of a sudden another sound comes in from somewhere. You know, might be an airplane sound or something, you know. And he's looking at the audience. He's getting this vibe from the audience because they dance for an hour. Sometimes they just dance and never stop. It's continuous dancing. Mm-hmm. People dancing on each other's shoulders and stuff, you know, sweating, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, you know, with jazz, it's constantly changing in the moment. Especially with, like, the experimental jazz and the stuff that Tribe was doing is constantly changing. You're not restricted to too much. Mm-hmm. But with this music, it's pretty repetitive, right? Techno is very repetitive.
Yeah.
But it also puts you into a trance, right? It puts you into more of like a meditative style of performing. What does it feel like?
It perceives like that. But I'm thinking all the time. Mm-hmm. It's perceived like that. The beat is not going anywhere. It can't go because people dance into that beat. So you got to make that beat interesting by playing different little ideas, you know, that's going to accommodate. It's like icing on the cake, you know. And you constantly think about, how can I make this a little more interesting, you know. Carl liked the clarinet because the clarinet wasn't used in that context. So I played a lot of the clarinet. He called me the snake charmer, you know. And people really dug it. They really dug that sound.
So the last track that I want to play and talk about is from a label that's new. Adrian Young and Ali Shahid Muhammad out in New York, they have a label called Jazz is Dead. What can you tell me about, you know, being approached from this new label and what they talked to you about?
Man, that was crazy. And 2 years ago, just before the pandemic, the year of the pandemic. So we went out there for about 3-4 days, constantly recording, constantly filming us. You got a lot of footage, and recorded for 2 days. And the studio is like a museum. He's got all kinds of old keyboards on the wall, and he's got like...
Yeah, for those that don't know out there, Ali Shahid Muhammad is from Tribe Called Quest, mm-hmm. And Adrian Young is this amazing producer that has a studio that he's like really a purist with traditional recording techniques. It's all tape, analog synthesizers, old ribbon microphones. He likes to keep the traditional way from like 50s until 70s way of recording. He wants to really bring that back in today's music. And he's bringing all these musicians that pretty much are musicians that people find out through like record collecting. Just like Tribe Records is somebody that like a record collector would find. He tries to get these artists together and record in this environment. And it's the song I want to listen to is called Fire in Detroit. What can you tell me about Fire in Detroit?
Well, the fire is two concepts. Before I went out there, I had a fire. My garage burned down. But that was on my mind. But now, I don't know what was on his mind. I think he was talking about the 1967-68 riots.
Yeah, that was my my guess when I saw the title was, oh, they wrote this about that, Rebellion, right?
Yeah.
Well, I think the whole project is great. Jazz is Dead by Adrian Young and Ali Shaheed Muhammad. And this is pretty much a brand new album that just came out recently. Phil Ranelin and Wendell Harrison's project on the Jazz is Dead label. Let's check it out. This is Fire in Detroit. Wendell Harrison, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for inviting me to this amazing studio.
So much.
WDET. This is great.
So much beautiful music you've made throughout your life, and I feel really honored to share it on the airwaves today. Yeah, so thank you so much for being here.
All right.